I think that he has already created a situation where, win or lose, there's going to be protesting and counter-protesting, and the level of suspicion and polarization has gotten so great that there are going to be guns in the streets. And this is a major concern of mine.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. This podcast began as an effort to track and get to know leaders who are mobilizing in resistance to Trump. Jeff Isaac is a longtime professor of political science at Indiana University, who's been very active in expressing his concerns about the Trump administration and has been working to mobilize others in his profession to protect the country. We spoke earlier this year, and Jeff is back to further discuss the threats that Trump poses to liberal democracy and his concerns about the upcoming election and how it will be administered. We had a good conversation. You should listen. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Professor Jeffrey Isaac.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Hi, Jeff. How are things lately? We talked earlier, and I think you had some things you wanted to get off your chest.
My biggest concern when we spoke earlier is the question of the future of liberal democracy in the United States, not only in the United States and other parts of the world too, but right now I'm particularly concerned about the U.S. and about the upcoming election and about the various ways that the fairness of the election can be hampered and the ways in which Trump is quite clearly trying to call into question the legitimacy of the election and to establish certain expectations, but also, I think, through litigation and other means, to do everything possible to basically, at the same time that he's claiming Democrats are rigging the election, he's trying to rig the election. And I think it's increasingly clear, although it's not certain, that in a fair election, he would probably lose. There are serious concerns about whether there will be a fair election, and also if there is not a very decisive electoral outcome, what will be the consequence in the streets? So these are my concerns. They're the concerns of my writing and teaching.
I mean, we have had many elections, many national elections, I guess particularly in the 19th century, but even subsequently, 2000, some people say 2004 even, where the result wasn't in accord with a popular vote, or where the vote in a particular state, if you look at it carefully, the wills of the voters that actually voted was not the same as the count. Like, I think that's pretty clear in Florida in 2000. Why do you think that this is like an order of magnitude different than it has been before things that we have survived as a democracy?
So I'm teaching a seminar on this called Is Democracy on the Ballot? Is U.S. Democracy on the Ballot in November? And I think it is. So why do I think it is? I do think this situation is unprecedented. And part of the way that I talk to my students about this and I teach through discussion about this is through a kind of simple, let's just say, sociology of knowledge. The fact of the matter is the extent to which commentators across the political spectrum are raising these issues, it's unprecedented in my lifetime. Something like the Lincoln Project or Republicans for the Rule of Law or the wide range of commentators across the spectrum, including former military officials. And quite honestly, the piece that Jeffrey Goldberg published in The Atlantic, I'm not talking about the recent piece in which Trump disparages basically the commitment and sacrifice of military people. But he published an interview with General Mattis a couple of months ago, in which Mattis said, as he has also been quoted as saying in the new Bob Woodward book, that Trump is a threat to the Republic. The extent to which this, across the board, in almost a bipartisan way, is a concern of people at every level of government and out of government, former Trump officials in government. You know, I don't have great regard for people like Scaramucci or Michael Cohen or Amorosa, but the extent to which people associated even with Trump are saying this says something. The extent to which there is a public conversation now about whether and how there might be military interventions. And, you know, there are serious public statements being made by military people about this question. This is unprecedented. It's not like the 2000 election, although the 2000 election in some ways kind of anticipated some of these issues. The issues do implicate broader themes about the Electoral College and its anachronistic features, broader questions about democratic legitimacy. But the fact is, we have in power, I believe, but not just me, an aspiring autocrat, someone who is already behaving like an authoritarian, who has no regard for liberal democracy, and who is promoting and inciting a kind of civil violence among some of his supporters and a distrust of the basic principle that political adversaries are not enemies, creating a situation, I think, where the Republican Party has become almost an anti-system party in political science jargon. So this is unprecedented, in my opinion.
What agrees with that is his kind of open admiration of leaders around the world who have managed to move their power towards a less democratic, more dictatorial mode, you know, and he seems to wish that he could have parades like North Korea, to wish that he could consolidate power like the premier of China, to admire Putin. These are kind of tells, right, that he wants to go that way. On the other hand, I have a feeling that deep down, he is a little different than that, that he enjoys poking the bear of liberal Democrats a little in this country, that at the end of the day, he may not really have these aspirations, but he just kind of plays with it. Where do you think you might be on the, what they might think of as the Trump derangement syndrome scale? How much do you think you're over worrying versus maybe some people are really under worrying?
This is a big topic and one that I've written about a lot, and actually it annoys and disturbs me. The concept of Trump derangement syndrome, I think, is a completely specious concept. I don't consider myself deranged, but I'm quite opposed to it. You said something like at the end of the day. We're very close to the end of the day now.
We're going to find out within 2 months whether our worst fears are true, whether this guy is going to deny the results of a national election that goes against him and try to hold on to power at the risk of giant catastrophe, people shooting each other in the streets even, and the risk of the American experiment. The fact that we could consider that is highly alarming, but it's hard to know.
Of course, it's hard to know. And so, I mean, as a matter of political science or informed commentary, I think that, you know, there's a dimension of this that we can't know, and it's interesting to argue about it. I would argue that, in fact, he has already done so many very terrible things that have long-term consequences. I don't see, by the way, his utter lying and malignant way of handling COVID as unrelated to this. I don't. But surely the fact that there is blood in the streets and that he is inciting it, and he's telling his supporters to vote twice. He's talking now about this so-called Durham report. He and Barr are poised to come out with a completely politicized document claiming that Obama and Clinton and the Democrats spied on him in 2016 and tried to steal the election from him, and that they're traitors. And this goes far beyond partisan campaigning. It goes far beyond what any incumbent president has ever done. It is already authoritarian in many ways. Does this mean that he can't be defeated at the ballot box? I don't know. It's my job to be talking about this and teaching about this for years, including, you know, retrospectively analyzing those aspects of the situation that may have been misinterpreted. But the fact is, we're also citizens. And as scholars and intellectuals, we have a certain sense of, let's just say, public responsibility. It's insane not to err on the side of caution here, especially since all I'm doing in everything that I'm doing and saying, I'm not calling upon people to like rip their hair out or emigrate or whatever. I'm calling on people to like pay attention and vote and get their colleagues and their friends to vote and to be prepared to defend liberal democracy and fair elections if there is, in fact, an impairment of them. That seems like an intelligent kind of caution in a democracy. To say stuff like, well, we don't know in the end what will happen. Any scholar who says that is someone who's willing to either claim for themselves a kind of ivory tower detachment, which in fact is simply an illusion, or they're promoting themselves or justifying former claims that they made. Like there are quite prominent people, we've talked about them, I think, who for the past 4 years have been saying, if you worry about Trump, it's Trump derangement syndrome, you're a tyrannophobe, whatever. I get where people like that have a vested interest in continuing to say about people like me, you know, you're just freaking out. But I'm not freaking out. What I'm doing now, I'm talking about voter registration, voter identification, and education, and I'm taking seriously the democratic process. I don't see how that's deranged.
Well, I'm not saying it is. I'm just giving you an opportunity to respond. I mean, the things that concern me are the political use of the HHS budget to advertise, to make COVID seem not as bad, to use the White House lawn to campaign, try to set up the Biden son, you know, the thing that he was impeached about, the different types of October surprise things that he's trying to put in place, the kind of different levers of political control of the economy that are not unprecedented, but are, I feel like, pretty blatant and maybe beyond what we've seen before. It's so clear in kind of the reporting out of people who've talked to him, the way that he wants to only give aid to red states, not blue states, or hold it back from Democratic controlled cities. So much is politicized that is inappropriate, and all in his theory of what it will take for him to win in an unenlightened way. I mean, all of that is disturbing and in line with what you're worried about, isn't it?
Absolutely. Although I would simply say that, like, this entire conversation is interesting to me, and I enjoy talking to you, and these issues are very important. But kind of like in the lead up to the election, I've decided that, like, I'm no longer really interested in discussing the analytical question about what are the dimensions of the Trumpist danger, or how it historically compares to other dangers. It's not the only danger, or to what extent it's symptomatic of deeper issues with American society and politics. Of course it is. I would simply say this, and this is part of the way in which I teach this question, which is a question for my students about whether democracy is on the ballot. It's pretty clear that there are two very different visions of the future of America, both of which are speaking about this as a crucial election. Trump also says it's a crucial election. And what the Republican Party said at its convention is, we're not going to have a platform, but we pledge ourselves to the president because he stands between American civilization and American greatness and chaos. That's a position. It's a position that says nothing about democracy, human rights, anything else. That's a choice. On the other hand, you have a Democratic platform that begins by speaking about the Declaration of Independence and democracy. And you have an extraordinary situation where, like, a wide range of former Republicans are endorsing this Democrat. And they're not only endorsing the Democrat, they're calling for the profound defeat of the party that until yesterday they belonged to, because they see it as enabling an autocrat. So there's a choice. And at this moment, all I'm interested in is saying there's a choice. If we care about democracy, we should care about this choice. And from my vantage point, what this means is it's glaring, and one of the choices is very dangerous. But even simply from a pedagogical point of view, in terms of the work I'm doing or trying to do within the political science profession, I'm not calling for my colleagues to become political organizers in their classrooms, but I am calling on them to teach about democracy and the importance of this moment, and also teach about voter education for students who are citizens. Let them vote as they want. I don't tell my students how to vote, but I hope they'll vote. And I think it's really important that they understand what is at stake in this election in a broad sense by paying attention to what's being said and done. And I think it's really important that they understand the ways in which the democratic process itself is being pushed to the limit by this president and his party. That's what I'm about. How will it unfold? I don't know. Is it possible that Trump will actually win a fair election? Yes, it is possible. In that event, what does that mean? Will I advocate insurrection? No. Everything I'm doing is centered around the importance of procedural democracy. Everything we know about the situation and everything that is being said by, if General Mattis says it, that's not meaning something. Okay. I think it means a lot when some of the people who surrounded Trump and got him elected are saying it. I think that's telling us that we need to really, really worry about it.
Well, it seems to me when Dan Coats, a conservative Republican senator from your state who is running intelligence, is saying that he's not sure, he feels like Russia has something on him because he can't explain the president's behavior any other way, that's hair-raising.
It's hair-raising, and it's really unprecedented. Within the Republican Party, there's a hardcore base, and there are very opportunistic leaders like McConnell who are like in. They're just in with this. They're in with Trump. But the extent to which many elements of the Republican Party and its intellectual core for decades have defected is extraordinary. I wish Coates would speak out. You know, I wish Jeff Flake had done a lot more before he left the Senate. But the fact that he's now endorsing Biden, or that Kasich spoke at the Democratic convention, or Christy Tarr Whitman, you could talk about a lot of people. I wish that George W. Bush would speak out. I know that everyone that surrounded him is speaking out against this. Some of my friends on the left are very troubled by this. I understand the trouble. They don't want the Biden campaign or administration to be that broad-based that it's forgetful of the progressive forces that played such an important role in the primary and that really are energizing the future of the party. I agree with that. But the extent to which there is this movement against Trump on the grounds that he is a threat to democracy itself is unprecedented. The Lincoln Project, these guys, I mean, just listen to what they're saying. What they're saying is right. And these are all people who've been working for the Republican Party for decades.
So tell me a few of the things that you've been doing in the run-up to this election, starting with the spring. What have you been up to because of this situation?
Well, first of all, I mean, I've been trying to do a lot, collaborating with some colleagues in some of what I've done, in other ways just through my writing. But I wouldn't exaggerate the importance of like my efforts in particular. But I would say this, going back to early March, I drafted an open letter that I then circulated among my political science colleagues with my own colleague, Will Wyckoff. I couldn't have done it without him. And within 48 hours, our open letter had over 1,000 signatures of political scientists across the spectrum. And that open letter was about the need to take seriously election security and protecting the fairness of the election and the accessibility of voting in the face of COVID. It was building heavily on Brennan Center and other recommendations that, you know, were disparaged by the Trump administration and have been opposed by the Republicans in the Senate and in the House. And so they've pretty much gone nowhere. That was about COVID and the threat to democracy. But behind it, I think, was a general fear that the governing authority in this country, which is with Trump and the Republicans, will take advantage of any opportunity to obstruct a free and fair democratic election. Since that open letter, everything I've been doing has been much more oriented towards not simply COVID, but towards the broader danger of Trumpist authoritarianism, particularly as the situation has evolved over the summer with Black Lives Matter protests and the counter protests and the so-called Blue Lives Matter movement, and the way that Trump has incited and also deployed violence. I've been very active as a blogger and as a political commentator about these events. The thing that I really want to talk about that seems to be the only important thing in the next couple of months is activity designed to encourage colleagues to do everything in their power to promote voter registration and voter education among the young people with whom they interact regularly as part of their jobs as academics, and to do everything possible to highlight the importance of protecting a free and fair election in November. And so I published a piece at the political science blog, Duck of Minerva, that recently was republished at the American Political Science Association's Political Science Now website. What the title of the piece is U.S. political scientists must work to support free and fair democratic elections. That piece is an argument about, let's say, the distinctive vocation of political science as a discipline and profession, and the things that any political scientist who teaches about politics, and particularly American political scientists who teach about democracy, as almost every American political scientist does, the responsibility that goes along with that at this moment to pay attention to and support free and fair democratic elections. A lot of what I've been doing has been trying to engage my profession, in which I'm pretty well networked, and speaking with, writing with. I sent that piece along with a letter to every chair of every political science department in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, and Wisconsin, because these are crucial states in which I think it's important to pay attention to the entire electoral process and also important to encourage people to vote.
What kind of response did you get from that?
Among my friends, I've gotten a lot of positive, very positive response. I should say that part of what I've been doing, both in that piece and in my blogging and in these letters, is also highlighting the other things that are being done. So that, for example, the American Political Science Association has this terrific initiative called Raise the Vote. Most political scientists even don't really know enough about this. And I don't think the association has done a good job of promoting it, of publicizing it. But there are a lot of resources out there and a lot of efforts going on campuses across the country that a lot of people don't know about, examples, models. And so part of what I'm trying to do is simply promote those, publicize those, and network with other people who are involved in these things. On my own campus at Indiana University, there's a so-called Big Ten Voter Challenge, which takes place at every election. And I think that campuses across the country promote voter education and voter registration as part of their general civic education mission. One of the people I sent my letter to is a colleague who's also the president of University of Pennsylvania, Amy Gutman. She wrote me back thanking me and, you know, telling me about some of the things that they're doing over there to promote voter registration and voter education. I think those things are going on. I think that much more can be done, and it particularly, I think much more ought to be done in classrooms within the bounds of professional responsibility and nonpartisanship.
I feel like there's some conflict between what you just called the bounds of responsibility and partisanship and the notion that this particular guy, the Republican standard bearer, our president, is not a normal partisan figure. Why not teach rather than you should vote, you need to vote this time for Biden? What stops you from calling for that more clear effort?
There's the question of what stops me. And then there's the question of how I argue in public. For me to make that move in my public advocacy and to try to convince large numbers of my colleagues who are members of the American Political Science Association would be kind of to delegitimize what I'm saying. I think a great many political scientists take very seriously a concept of value neutrality. I understand that. Whether I share it or not is beside the point. So I think arguing for a more partisan position
the point is that in this moment, that isn't just partisanship, as you've argued earlier in this very interview.
I do agree with that. I agree with you. But I also think that many people will not see it that way. I would never say in any class ever, nor would I advocate that any colleague ever say, vote for Joe Biden. Okay. And I never tell my students what to do. I would never tell them who to vote for. Even if I said to them, in my opinion, for these reasons, I believe that Donald Trump is pushing the limits of democracy in a way that they've never been pushed before, I will not tell them what to do. That is not my job as a teacher. The classroom is not a political podium. I am absolutely committed to that idea. Other people disagree. Fine. They have the right to do a lot of things within the bounds of academic freedom that perhaps don't seem appropriate to me. So in none of my classes do I tell people what to do. I do raise questions for them, and I also talk with them about what sustains some of the institutions and values that they seem to take seriously and what they might do if they regard these institutions and values in danger. So I think that's kind of an answer to your question, but maybe it's not, and you need to push me farther. So push me.
Well, I wonder, let me ask this question. I mean, there is certainly there's a large amount of people who think that in this vote, democracy is at stake.
I agree with that.
But I would say that there are more people who don't agree with that or don't know that. And the urgency in the wide electorate is not focused on the continuing of democracy or not. It's focused on the personalities, other issue positions, standard other issue questions, the state of the economy, but not necessarily on this existential question.
I agree. I think that's true. By the way, I do think that even in terms of the campaigns, the existential question is looming incredibly large. And, you know, Biden, his whole candidacy centered on a claim he was making about the existential question.
The battle for the soul of the nation.
Yes. And what's interesting about it is, okay, he wasn't my favorite candidate, but he won. And even before he won, the honest truth is that Rashida Tlaib and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and some of the most left Democrats were also saying this is about the future of democracy. And now they're saying it even more loudly, and Bernie Sanders is saying it because I think it's true. But the point is, I do think that both campaigns, both parties are pitching it in this way. And part of the reason why they are is because they believe that this can resonate or does resonate with lots of people. However, I do want to say I'm not a political consultant. I don't make political advertisements. I'm not telling Joe Biden or anyone else how to campaign. And surely it's the case that a wide range of things might influence voters. And surely it's the case that COVID is one. And, you know, maybe what LeBron James says is one. That's fine. And LeBron should do what he can do. But I'm an educator. And I'm a political science scholar. And so it's not my job to give advice about political advertising. It is my job to teach about what's going on and to teach about how the institutions of our society are working, and also to teach about the values behind those institutions that most of us as colleagues simply take for granted. Some of us don't. And so for people like me, the normativity of democracy has always been central to my teaching about democracy.
What do you think specifically is at stake if this president is elected and he can continue to move down the road that he seems to want to go down? What are the freedoms, the values, the policies that you think are going to change for the worse?
Well, I think everything's going to change for the worse. You asked me about freedoms and policies. Policies are important. This Republican Party has no real policy agenda. If you think about COVID, or if you look at the burning of the West Coast of our country right now, these things are only going to get worse unless they're addressed by serious public policy response, which the Republican Party is simply not about. That's an argument, or at least an opinion. But I'm not making policy arguments so much as I am making procedural arguments. So what are the things that I think might happen if Trump is reelected? First of all, I really do think that his performance in office, particularly with COVID.
Well, I mean, I would expect you to say, and I think myself, that things like the freedom of the press are endangered by this whole fake news thing and by his interest in only hearing good things, that right to assembly, you know, different things in the Bill of Rights that we hold dear are things that he might change. He would love to move to a system of elections which is even more rigged to the benefit of himself only. Is that too much of a stretch?
No, that's, I was going exactly there, but I was going to say that given COVID, the only way he can win is unfairly. What's going on right now and the scenario of a fair victory for Trump is so threadbare, I believe. It's not impossible.
He's got a 40% chance of winning still.
Perhaps. I mean, I know what some of the pollsters say.
I mean, it's not just polls. It's things will change between now and then. He's got some moves to make. And he's good at throwing stuff up at the wall and seeing what will happen, including, you know, the so-called Obamagate you referenced. But there's going to be other things. He might try a war.
I'm not a forecaster. Yeah, he has a chance. I agree. That's why I'm so urging engagement now. Of course he can win. By the way, my point about COVID is if he wins fairly, okay, that says something about how profoundly the public discourse has been poisoned and the media landscape has been corrupted, perhaps beyond repair. Okay, that's not all on him. It's on other things too. But a lot of it will be on his complicity with Fox News and his use of social media, and that is part of, like, let's just say, the institutional infrastructure of a very flawed constitutional liberal democracy. So the very possibility that he can get 40% of the vote already speaks to ways in which he has polluted the political environment, in my opinion, in ways that render liberal democracy deeply precarious. Having said all that, I would simply go in the direction that you said. If he wins in terms of freedom of assembly, in terms of freedom of the press, in terms of the use of the Justice Department to prosecute and persecute political opponents, which is already happening, in terms of the transformation of the bureaucracy into a sheer cronyism and corruption, in terms of the defunding of educational institutions which do not promote his agenda, which is to some extent going on now, all of those things will become much more important. I think they're likely. I would say one other thing, civil violence. In some ways, we are on the verge of a civil war. In some ways, he is promoting this. And he has been promoting this ever since he's been going around in the country, starting in 2017, speaking in places like Indianapolis and talking about what he calls Second Amendment solutions, which is his term. I think that he has already created a situation where, win or lose, there's going to be protesting and counter-protesting. And the level of suspicion and polarization has gotten so great that there are going to be guns in the streets. And this is a major concern of mine. In fact, it's what I've been writing about most recently. I wrote an open letter to the police chief and the mayor of Bloomington, Indiana. And in fact, I met with the police chief on Zoom and the captain of operations this week to talk about these things. And I think any intelligent police department is aware of this, the extent to which the election is linked to the possibility of civil violence. That's a very serious thing. Trump has already created that situation.
One of the interesting things about Trump is he's become such a threat, even though he keeps making such egregious mistakes.
Yeah.
That undermine his ability to consolidate power. Like on a daily basis, his mistakes are holding him down.
Yeah, I agree.
It tells you something about the vulnerability of our system that he's done as well as he has.
I agree with you. It speaks about the vulnerability of the system, and it's not just about him. I mean, you know, sending him packing is just like the first step of so many. And I'm not just talking again about, like, let's just say socioeconomic or environmental policy. I'm talking about strengthening the institutions of constitutional democracy. This goes to something you said earlier that I agree with you about. He's very unique. In some ways, he's an idiot. And in some ways, he's more of a nihilist than any of these other guys, Orban, Putin, Erdogan, maybe even Bolsonaro, like it is like a serious fascist in a way in which, you know, Trump really is a narcissist. That does speak to some of his limitations as a political leader and maybe some of the ways he has not maximized some of the kinds of moves that he seems to have wanted to make. I agree with that, but that also makes him even more dangerous because he's in many ways very unpredictable. He has his finger on the nuclear button.
He's also got people hanging on his words. He's got people tattooing Trump on their forehead and not wearing masks to large gatherings because they think that he's given him that marching order. I think there's something interesting psychologically about the attraction that, you know, 100 million people seem to have to this.
Absolutely. And again, it's not all about procedural democracy, but procedural democracy is the institutional setup whereby, at least ideally, we in this country are supposed to resolve our political differences. We need to talk about the relationship between what you just said and COVID. It's fundamental. Before the election comes, over 200,000 people will have died of a disease that he has lied about and told people to, like, maybe inject Clorox into their veins. And people are still going to his rallies without masks and supporting him. This is so dangerous. How do we typologize it in terms of authoritarian regime character? Yeah, okay, well, let's talk about that. What are the institutions of constitutional democracy that are most at risk? Yeah, we need to talk about that. But we also need to talk about the fact that, like, hundreds of thousands of us are dying. And it's only going to get worse with this.
He's going to come up with a miracle vaccine on November 2nd.
Yeah, again. And people will believe that, yes. He didn't create the terrible mass-mediated, social-mediated public discourse that allows for a carnival barker and reality TV star who claims to be a business success but never has really been one to become president. He didn't create that situation. He exploited it. He took advantage of it. And he now is kind of the master of it. But the fact of the matter is, he is taking that situation and destroying so much of what is valuable in this society, including the lives of the people.
I hear, like, a skeptical listener thinking, you're overstating this. Life hasn't changed that much. Maybe the COVID has changed things more, but, like, the economy was doing fairly well under him. He was reportedly making all these changes about the environment, but I didn't see any of those actually hit me. You know, he was reducing immigration or trying to, and I'm for that. You know, I don't like the trade deals that he doesn't like. There are non-irrational creatures who are aligned with him, aren't there?
You know, the language of rationality and irrationality, I mean, for polemical purposes, I'm quite happy with it, but it's too simplistic. I wouldn't say that his supporters are irrational. They're all lunatics or something like this. I mean,
they're not lunatics. They see the world through a different lens.
Well, they absolutely do. There's no question about it. And you ask this question as a skeptic. I don't think anyone who's with Trump is a skeptic. And I'm not interested in persuading anyone who's with Trump. I'm not. I never am. Okay. I think that there are political leaders that need to pay some attention to that, particularly in the future. My own belief right now politically is that what's needed is to defeat them, not to destroy them, to defeat them at the ballot box, and then use the powers of government as supported by some kind of real electoral mandate to institute the kinds of changes that might create a more healthy democracy and might generate a better political discourse in which tens of millions of people are just putting on these stupid orange hats and saying, lock her up still, okay?
I think I agree with you there. And it feels like we better attend, if we win this, if Biden wins this, and we better attend to sort of the equivalent of, I don't know, debathification or denazification or reconstruction or something done well. Those are not the good examples necessarily, but, like, to purge out some of the poison out of the veins of the Republic.
Absolutely. The analogy of the denazification goes too far because we're not there yet, and I'm not saying we are. But a lot of intelligent people have talked about a new reconstruction. My colleague, Tom Pepinski, had a really good blog post calling for a kind of truth and reconciliation commission. There's no question. So one of the really interesting organizations that has formed, it's very bipartisan. It's called, I think, the Transition Project.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, okay. And it's addressing exactly this question. What needs to be done beyond this election to renovate American democracy? Clearly, a lot needs to be done. I agree with you. Things aren't like cataclysmic. So I have a very serious conversation with my son, who's a brilliant 34-year-old guy. He's not an academic, and he's much more of a skeptic than I am, and he's much more iconoclastic in his beliefs than I am. And he predicted Trump's victory, and he's really worried about a Trump reelection. He's against Trump. And we talk about like moving to Canada, okay? If I thought we were on the verge of like Hitler, I would either move or I would be getting arms training, okay? I don't think that. And so I'm not doing those things.
You don't think we have concentration camps coming? You think we have erosion of rights?
Now I do.
Yeah.
By the way, there are concentration camps, but they're marginal, more or less marginal. I fear for the future. Do I rule out the possibility that 4 years from now I might be in that situation? No. I'm not going to endlessly argue for fair elections. If we no longer live in a constitutional democracy, then the question is what to do. I don't believe insurrection is ever a wise or ethically just approach. Self-defense is different than insurrection, but we're way down the road. You know, things are not yet a cataclysm, but I also think if you look, let's say, at the burning of the West, or you think about what happened in Puerto Rico, and the fact that after more than one hurricane, pretty much there's been nothing done. You think about the coasts and hurricanes in Louisiana, Alabama, the whole situation with New Orleans. You think about actually the East Coast, parts of New York City. I think more and more people in Florida, erosion, more and more people are going to see very, very obviously the ways that the situation is getting much, much worse for us all, unless we do something very serious to address what John Dewey called in 1927, the public and its problems. We need a renewed public life, or else so many of the tendencies that we currently experience are going to become so exacerbated. And I think it's going to become more and more manifest to more and more people. This doesn't mean that they're all going to become progressive. Okay. Some of them might be more viscerally fascist. Fascist solutions, fascist promises of public solutions, have appealed to certain people. I have no doubt this is one of the reasons why Bolsonaro was at least at some point somewhat popular.
I think his popularity is going up.
It may be. We can't refuse to take that seriously, but that's all the more reason to engage in an intelligent long-term strategy of, let's just say, liberal democratic democracy promotion everywhere, including here.
How do you do that in your classwork, for example?
I have a very open, engaged way of promoting discussion among my students and encouraging them to be honest. I mainly pose questions, but obviously I'm an experienced teacher who employs the Socratic method. So my questions are not without direction or purpose. I expose students to a range of media, and we talk about media, and I challenge them. I have a certain hopefulness about what I'm doing as a teacher. Part of it is related to the fact that I take the educational process very seriously, and I take them very seriously. I take their experiences seriously. There are great teachers. I don't consider, for some people, maybe I'm a great teacher, but I'm not tooting my own horn as a teacher. There are lots of great college teachers. And by the way, part of what I want to say is that some of these values that we're talking about, and part of this idea that I've been pressing, that political science, because it teaches about democracy, has a certain vocation to take these things seriously now, and without being simply proselytizing, to be informative and educational in ways that hopefully will encourage people to just take their civic responsibility seriously and make whatever choices they make. I do think it's not just political science as a discipline that has this kind of a public responsibility. And I think probably every social science and every humanistic discipline has a similar kind of perhaps public responsibility. How that gets argued is, I think, would have to vary from discipline to discipline. But I do think it's important for everyone who's an academic and who's a college teacher to be thinking about how they're teaching now and how the values that they're promoting through their pedagogy relate to what's going on in our world. And I would say the same thing about university administrators. So one of the things that I find a little frustrating is that I think it's fantastic that in the wake of Black Lives Matter, like university administrators everywhere, just like MBA administrators, have become very woke. They're being very public about offering resources to teach about racism and what's now, the term now is systemic racism. It used to be called institutional racism or whatever, or structural racism years ago, but it's the same idea. It's great that universities are committing themselves to teaching about this and to new policies of diversity, making very clear that given this new situation, they need to assume a new responsibility. That's excellent. And racism is bad and universities should be against it. And fascism is also bad and universities should be against it. And the same commitment to kind of civic education that has been articulated about racial issues by universities, which has also been used to defend restart and reopening of campuses in the face of COVID, that we need to bring our students here and teach them about civic responsibility. That same ethos needs to be, I think, more robustly promoted with regard to what we now face, which is the possibility of authoritarianism in our own country. We have no difficulty, at least many academic associations and administrators, acknowledging that elsewhere. You know, talking about academic freedom or the oppression in the streets of Belarus, for example. Okay, it's true that lots of universities have become complicit in through their you know recruitment of students abroad or through their university satellites abroad, complicit in, you know, authoritarianism in the Gulf states or elsewhere in Singapore or in China. But the truth of the matter is the rhetoric of civic education and civic responsibility is something that university administrators come very easily by. And I think now is the time for all university leaders, all academic leaders, all professional and disciplinary leaders, and teachers, scholars, academics, writers, to really pay attention to the threats to democracy that are taking place, not in Turkey or in China or in the Congo, but here in the United States.
I'm really quite sad that we do face that, and I think we do. If we switch horses here and we put Biden in office, that I'm going to stop worrying that every day that we're going down that road, and I know that we'll at least arrest that direction. I think we'll still have to worry about Trump saying stuff and his kids running for office and a lot of people who have been inspired and copycats of this method of coming to power. But I hope we make that change. Jeff, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk about this stuff. I know it could be 12 hours because there's so much, but is there a question that I failed to ask that I should have?
No, I first of all, it's easy to talk to you. You're a terrific interviewer and you're really smart and you care about these issues. And so your podcast is, I think, you know, uniformly excellent and illuminating. And the work of the future is for us all. Hopefully you'll continue doing this and, you know, have other venues. This kind of work is central work. I don't mean like talking to me. I mean, you raising the issues, talking to a lot of people and promoting intelligent public discourse. I agree with you that this election is all about like arresting, stopping, stanching a terrible bleeding. It doesn't really solve anything except it makes possible the solution of everything, or at least some effort to solve everything.
Yeah, we're going to immediately be at war with the midterm elections that are hard on the heels of the presidential. And it, you know, the way the patterns are, it's going to be a fight.
Up until very recently, I opposed Biden in the primary and I criticized him sharply and criticized this idea that what we needed was bipartisanship. And I still don't think what we need is bipartisanship. But I do agree that in the immediate aftermath, there needs to be a kind of political healing. This doesn't mean stopping debate or argument or pushing through a robust progressive agenda. But there are different ways of doing it. And I think Biden might be very well placed to create a political temperature. You know, he said this in a recent speech. He said, I don't want to raise the temperature. I want to lower it. I want to like chill us a little bit. And I do think we need to chill, even with regard to the 2022 elections. Hopefully, they'll be just that taking place at a little bit less of an intensity, because I think that the intensity is very dangerous. This kind of intensity, a different kind of intensity, maybe not, but the fear and suspicion makes people do some dangerous things.
Yeah, and people get hyped up and they start carrying weapons around in Portland or Seattle or Kenosha, and bad things happen. And we got to back off that. And
agree.
Yep.
Yes, we have to back off that.
Yep. And I think also that some of the reforms, democratic reforms, it would be best if they were passed 99-0.
Yes, although they won't be. There's no, because of what you said.
We can't change the Electoral College unanimously or something like that.
Yeah. But. Or, you know, the Republicans are going to be Mitch McConnell, hopefully, maybe even if he goes, a lot of his cronies will still be there obstructing things in the Senate. And it's a long-term process. It's true that, by the way, if Trump goes, a lot of those people may change their tune. Some of those people are just really opportunistic.
Quite a number of them said the worst possible things about Trump the day before he won office and then flipped. It's embarrassing.
The most recent Lindsay. Yeah, that's it. They have a commercial about him, which is devastating.
Well, I appreciate your time. That was Professor Jeffrey Isaac of Indiana University. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.